How many of you, under threat of being struck down by God if you lie? I want to keep this on the honest side this morning. How many of you would say you have a perfect marriage?
It's only 6 weeks in.
You're lucky you're still alive. It's amazing what can happen in 6 weeks. You know, with the exception of one guy, notice I didn't ask if you have the perfect spouse, because that's just inducing you to lie then. But this morning we're going to start a series of conversations for all the rest of you whose marriage is not perfect. And it's a series that I have entitled Happily Ever After. You know, when my girls were little, I used to read books to them virtually every night. And it was amazing to me how many of those books ended with the same line. And they all lived happily ever after. That became their dream. You know, I suspect that every little girl, probably every child, grows up with the idea that someday, if she's a princess, that there's going to be a prince charming who's going to come along, sweep her off her feet, treat her like the princess that she deserves to be treated like. They're sooner or later going to have to encounter some dragon that they're going to slay together, and they're going to then live happily ever after. That's everybody's dream. I don't think anybody ever walks down an aisle. I've done a lot of weddings, and I don't think any of them, certainly if I knew about it, they didn't walk down the aisle and stand before me. I don't think any of them ever walked down the aisle with the idea that this was temporary and wasn't going to be very good. Everybody walked down the aisle believing that what was about to occur was permanent, was going to last for a lifetime, and it was going to be happily ever after. And yet we know beyond a shadow of a doubt the statistics are in, and that simply is not true for the vast majority of people. You know, all the statistics would tell us that happily ever after, it just isn't that easy to come by. In fact, there are many, many people in this world today who have come to the conclusion that happily ever after isn't even possible. And so they just kind of make do with what they can. Can I define happily ever after for you? In the context of marriage, happily ever after is living a mutually satisfying marriage relationship in which each other are respected and God is honored. I mean, if you can achieve that, life doesn't get much sweeter than that. That's about as good as you can hope for. Can I tell you something? From one fallen person to another, it is possible. If that's the definition, happily ever after is possible. I say that because through no fault of my own, I have it. I mean that too. The emphasis is on through no fault of my own. I married a woman who is, without question, the best of the best. I thought I was getting beautiful. I really got way more than that. In my household, and the young men that live in my household, we have a lot of conversations about relationships. I suspect anytime you got young people around, there's going to be a lot of conversation. And one of the questions that I get asked most frequently by these young men is, where did you find Miss Ann? I want one like her. And they've come to the conclusion there isn't another one out there like her. I agree with them. There really isn't. I've heard it said, and it's true, wise men marry up. How they do it, I don't know, because they really don't know what they're doing, and that was kind of my situation. I married up, I married way up. Believe me on that one. I feel like when I talk about marriage, and I want you to understand this, I only have one marriage that I can use as an example, and that's mine, with all of its warts and failures and successes, and yet through all that, I feel like I have led a charmed life. I have a wonderful wife. I've had two daughters. that I simply could not be more proud of. They both married wonderful men and have produced four splendid grandchildren. And the old bumper sticker is true. My grandkids are cuter than your grandkids. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. And I pray he doesn't, but if God stripped all of this away from me today, I would have no complaints in life. I would have still led a charmed and a blessed life. I don't say this to brag. I don't feel even slightly superior, and I don't want to say anything that would make you feel inferior. That's not my point. My point is that happily ever after is possible. And it's not really as impossible, even as difficult as some of us might imagine that it is. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's always easy, because it's not. And happily ever after doesn't necessarily look like you think it's going to look like. But it is possible, and there can come a day that you can sit back and you can look back at life and you can say, wow, I would not have wanted to have spent my life with another person than the one I've spent it with. So we're going to spend the next 12 Sundays, today and 11 more, talking about how to live happily ever after. Now, I need to tell you, Billy and I sat down with the list, and Billy immediately grabbed several of the topics because he felt like he was an expert in those subjects. And
you can say that now because my wife's not in the room.
I see.
You can say it the second service.
Okay. But if I do, she gets to rebut anything. I see. You know. And since I didn't feel like I was an expert in any, all the rest of them fell to me. So here we go. Every message that we're going to talk about is designed to teach some very simple concept. I want to be very clear. Over the next few weeks, this is going to be, I don't even want to call it preaching. I don't want to preach for the next 12 weeks. And all God's people said amen. But what I really want to do is I want to have a conversation with you as much as possible. And talk simply about some of the things that allow us to live happily ever. I want to say something to those of you who may not at the moment be married. There's much you can gain over the next 12 weeks in just relational soundness. Virtually, not entirely, but virtually everything that we're going to talk about can be applied to virtually any kind of relationship. And so we're going to talk about very simple concepts, one concept a week. And at the end of this time, every week, we're going to send you home with an assignment. Something that I want you to do. So I want you to agree as husband and wife right now that you're going to put pressure on the other one, lovingly, graciously, but pressure the other one to do the assignment. Because here's how it works. If this is my counseling office and you happen to all be sitting here at the moment, I can sit here and I can tell you all kinds of things that I think that you should do to improve your marriage, and if you go home and file them away as something you know and you don't do them, it's not going to be long before you're going to need the same advice all over again. But if you'll begin to form some habits today, begin to do some things on a repeated basis, then you really do have a chance of changing some things in your life that allows you to live happily ever after. Now, I want to put some disclaimers around this conversation. There's real danger in talking about the subject of marriage. First of all, that danger is to me, because I've discovered something. Every time I preach on marriage, my wife and I have a fight. It invariably works that way. I started gearing her up for it about a month ago and said, babe, start praying about this, because you know as well as I do it happens. Every time I start to talk about it, the enemy takes his best shot and tries very hard to distract me during this. So far, so good. I'll report in every week on this service when she's not here. But it just seems to be the case. But there are three disclaimers I want to make. First of all, my goal is not to make anyone feel defeated or guilty about their past. It's really to try to help you change your future. Every one of us have a past. Every one of us have done things in the past or not done things in the past that we would rather not have to own up to. You can't do what you don't understand. And probably all of us have lived for years with things that we didn't understand, and as a result of it, we've done some things that we're not all that pleased with and not all that proud of. And my goal in holding up a biblical standard is not to make you feel guilty. It's to help you be able to move from this point on and to be able to live in a way that would be God-honoring from this place on. I'm not desiring to beat anybody up or make an illustration out of anybody. Now, my second disclaimer is, I don't wish to say anything harmful or hurtful to anyone. I am almost positive that before this series is over, I'm going to say something that is going to hurt someone. I simply don't know how to do this without bringing back a memory, something that's transpired in their history that is enormously painful, maybe something they did, something that was done to them. I don't know how to do this without bringing up those kinds of memories. And I want you to understand that if that happens, it was not intentional. I'm not attempting to hurt anyone. I just simply want us to be able to talk about the realities of where we are in terms of marriage and move forward from this point. The third thing I want you to understand is I do not have a camera in your home. It seems like every time I talk on the subject of marriage, somebody walks up to me and says, "Do you have a camera? Are you watching me?" And the answer is no. I've just been where you are. I talk to enough people about marriage. I know what's going on in your home because it's gone on in mine and it's going on in most of them around the country. And what you're doing or have done and experiencing and have experienced is not all that dramatically different than anybody else's. I mean, we've all been down this road. You know, and then you got this problem that the Word of God is sharp and it's able to put its finger through the power of the Holy Spirit right on that spot in your life that happens to be at your worst moment today. And when He does that, it isn't because I got a camera. It's because He knows what's going on in your life and He knows what's going on in your home and He's going to apply it. Now, what is the condition of marriage today? I'm not asking specifically. I mean, you can certainly think about it in terms of your marriage, but what's the condition of marriage in our culture today? There is an organization that's called the National Marriage Project. It was originally hosted at Rutgers University. It is now hosted at the University of Virginia. It is a years-long study by an organization of social scientists who are studying marriage from a social science position. It's fascinating to me how many of their conclusions are biblical while most of them are not believers. But if you study marriage objectively, you're going to come to an ultimate conclusion. And the ultimate conclusion is, if you'll live marriage God's way, you're far better off than if you try to go it on your own. There are 10 statements that I'm going to give you this morning that summarize for us rather quickly what is the condition of marriage in America. Number one, their report, by the way. If you ever want to read them, they're online. They're rather lengthy. I've read the last four or five of them, and they're about 100 pages long. But they're fascinating information, and they're called the title of their annual report is called The State of Our Unions. So what is the state of our unions? Number one, we are less likely to marry today than we were in 1960. Now, it's going back about 50 years, and if you compare the probability that we're all going to marry, doesn't tell us necessarily how great marriage is, but it may give us some clue as to how our culture thinks about marriage. And the fact is, we are about 50% less likely to marry today than we would have been in 1960. Marriage is, in that sense, is in decline. We tend to get married later today than we did in 1960. For women in 1960, the average age to marry was 20. Today it's 26. In 1960, the average age for men to marry was 23. Today, it's 28. We are delaying the start of marriage. Now, that's not necessarily all bad. A little maturity under our belt, a little life experience is not necessarily all that negative. However, if you look behind the data, what you find is that much of that is being driven by the fact that people are living together outside of marriage before they get married. And we'll take a look at some of those numbers in a minute. Number three, the number of American couples who are married has declined in recent years. In fact, if you just go out and count, and count on a consistent basis, by that I mean how many out of 1,000 are married today. There's been a reduction, a decline in marriage of about 15% in the last 50 years, but since 1960. The divorce rate has doubled. Do I have the wrong? All right, okay, don't. Getting a slide in there. Divorce rate has doubled in the last 50 years. The divorce rate hit its peak in early 1980s. It has declined ever so slightly in the last few years. But the simple truth is, the experts say that that's just a leveling off at a very high level. If you get married today, based on the best probabilities that we can project, you still to this day stand between a 40 and a 50% chance of divorcing before one of the spouses dies. And that's if it's a first marriage. If it's a second or subsequent marriage, it goes up. After everyone, you would think, wouldn't you? You'd think that if we did it the next time around, we would be a little smarter, get a little more right. That doesn't appear to be the case. In fact, I will tell you in my experience that most couples who have been married and find someone believe that they are more prepared for marriage than they really are. And the result is that they make hasty decisions, end up getting themselves in situations that many of them wish they hadn't, and the net result is that the divorce rate for second and subsequent marriages is higher than it is for first. More people are living together outside of marriage, are we in sync now, than before? About one quarter of unmarried women between the ages of 25 and 39 are currently living with a sexual partner outside of marriage. Another 25% are not now, but have. And then if you want to take that to the next step, well over half of all first marriages are preceded by living together, compared to virtually none 50 years ago. If you talk to someone who are married today, most of them will give you two dates or two numbers of years. They'll say, we've been together for X amount of years and we've been married for X amount of years. And the truth is there's a difference because there's this period of time that people live together believing that that is in some way preparing them for marriage. We're going to debunk that myth coming up here in one of the subsequent weeks, and we're going to talk very candidly about that. Because for all of you who believe that, the evidence is not on your side. In fact, there is consistent across the board evidence that living together before you get married does not prepare you for marriage, but the very simple truth is that what it does is it heightens the probability that you are going to divorce by somewhere between 38 and 50%. You got to be straight with the numbers here. Number seven, the total fertility rate has declined to just slightly more than 2 children per woman. Now, what does that mean? It means we're at virtual break-even point. That we are where once there was an attitude that marriage was really all about having a family. That's no longer the case. The number of children per family has been in decline for several years. We're now at the break-even point. If we look at several industrialized nations, there's a high probability that it's going to go down. There's enormous social impact on the fact that in industrialized, the wealthier nations of the world, there are fewer children, and in the poor nations of the world, that fertility rate is much higher. And those segments of the population worldwide are growing very rapidly compared to what they are in the industrialized world. Simply stated, there are more children living in fragile families today. And by fragile, I'll just put it out there. It's, for the most part, fragile families are fatherless families. They're families in which children are living only with a mother. 26% of all children under the age of 18 are living with a single parent today. Only 18% of that group are living with their father. And that is the highest it's ever been. So there's some interesting dynamics going on in terms of that. The percentage of children living with two parents has declined by more than 20% since 1960. There's no way to distinguish in that number, by the way, how many of them are step-parents and how many of them are biological parents. One thing we do know is that step-parent families are much higher than they were in 1960. The percentage of babies born to unwed mothers has increased more than 7 times since 1960. That has profound social impact, because the truth is most of them are, not all, most of them are born into low-income families that end up putting a requirement on the state to help support over a long period of time. Now, that's kind of the state of our unions. That's where marriage is. And as a pastor and as a father and as someone who is just deeply concerned about marriages and what the impact of that is, I want you to see five reasons why I think this series is so critical. And then I'm going to talk about one Bible passage, make a point, and then I'm done. All right? My first reason for this series is simply the pain and frustration and hopelessness that I see in many married couples. I'm just telling you, folks, if you'll go out on the street, I've done this. I've done this in the last few weeks. I've sat down and just randomly talked to people and told them, you know, I'm preparing some material on marriage. Would you answer a handful of questions? And you know what I'm hearing time and time again is I'm on my third, fourth marriage, and it's okay. But there's this sense of resignation that marriage, happily ever after, being married to someone and being genuinely happy and wanting to, you know, to spend time with that person, it's almost an anomaly in American culture. And the idea that that can be one person for a lifetime seems foreign to many of the people that I talk to. There is a sense of frustration and pain. I mean, you know this. If the two of you are struggling, what else is on your mind? I mean, if it's my marriage and it's my home, I can tell you nothing else is on my mind. I mean, there is no way I can live with that until I do something to bring resolution to it and to put it back on track. I can't live with that kind of chaos. I don't think most people can. And since it happens so often, what they have to do is they have to bury it and they mask it and they keep on going and they act like it isn't there until someday it just boils over and explodes. And there is this pervasive sense of hopelessness that we can't get out of the cycle. I'm telling you, you can. Number two is the impact that struggling and broken marriages have on kids. If you write down nothing else I say today, if you get nothing else I say today, would you please hear this? The single greatest gift that you can give to your children is a home in which husband and wife visibly love each other. There is nothing that will provide a greater sense of security and stability to your family than to know that there is a mom and a dad who genuinely love each other and aren't afraid to show it. It is the single greatest gift that you can give to your children. Folks, there's boatloads of information on the impact of failed marriages on children. There are two images, and I'm not even going to give you the data. Over the weeks, we'll talk about some of the data. I want to paint two pictures for you. These two pictures crystallize in my mind the impact on kids more than anything else that I know. One of them is recently, for those of you who came and sat through the video, Sex and Money. It is a movie about American teenage girls who are, I was going to say pirated away, but they're not. They willingly put themselves in slavery to prostitution because for the most part they believe that they are first of all in love with a pimp. I mean, if you hear yourself saying this, it is so repulsive, it is so It is so bizarrely stupid, I don't know how else to say it. And I sat through that movie twice. And I watched it, and the only thing that was running through my head is every one of those girls could have been salvaged. You want to know how? They could have been saved by a father who loved them so dearly, who was willing to make them feel like the special person that they really are. And if they had had such a father, not all, but the vast majority of them would have never made the decisions that they made. And I can tell you, if they had a dad who treated them and treated their mother in such a way that he set an expectation. Do you understand this, dads? The way you treat your wife and the way you treat your daughters sets an expectation in the mind of your daughter. And when she starts to date, she's going to compare every one of those jerks, spoken like a father, she's going to compare every one of them to the standard you've set. And if you're not there, or you don't set the standard very high, or if you're messed up in your attitude toward women and you treat her like she's some kind of a second-class citizen, you're setting her up. As sure as can be, you're setting her up. That's the impact of failed marriages on kids. The second image in my mind is of young teenage boys who are standing looking at an authority figure defiantly, their hands on their hips, shouting obscenities, anger just boiling over. And the truth of the matter is, they're hurt beyond imagination. They're frightened because they have no idea how to live life. Nobody ever taught them. They don't know what it means to be a man because they didn't have one around to teach them how to be a man. And the net result of it is these kids are angry as can be. So you know how they take it out? Because most of the time there was a great conflict between their mother and their father, and they're trying to emulate him in some way, even in this insane kind of way that half the time they hate him and half the time they're trying to follow him. That's the pull of the father. And the net result of it is they have no idea how to live. They have no idea how to accept responsibility. They have no idea how to be a person of character. It doesn't even fit in their paradigm. That's the impact of broken families on kids. And then there's the impact of struggling marriages on the church. You know what I see the greatest impact in the church on broken families? I mean, there are all kinds of things that we can talk about, but I'll just give you another kind of mental image that sits in my mind. And it's the picture of someone who is stuck in their spiritual growth. Because you know what happens? Christianity, in its truest form, is lived out in relationship. You know, this ultimately isn't a religion about just believing all the right things. You understand that? It's about believing all the right things so that they ultimately affect the way we think and the way we live. And the fruit of the Spirit, you remember? Love, joy, peace, all those kinds of things. Those things that are the product of the Spirit of God working in your life and causing growth in your life. Every one of them are lived out in relationship. Now take that to the next step. The most significant relationship and the greatest indicator of your spiritual maturity. You with me? The greatest indicator of your spiritual maturity is the way you behave in your marriage. Do you understand? That's why there's this biblical statement about elders who are supposed to be mature individuals. And it says if he doesn't manage his own household well, he can't manage the church of God. The home is the microcosm of the church. If you don't live it at home, you ain't going to live it at church. It's that simple. Most people think it's the other way around. It's not. If you don't live it at home, if you're going to live it at church, you got to fake it to do it. And what happens is we get in these situations in our marriage and we don't handle them properly and we don't know what to do. And instead of growing through them, which is the purpose, isn't it? I mean, the whole idea is, why do we have these kind of difficulties? We have these kind of difficulties. I'm not even close to done. We have these kind of difficulties because they're to teach us something. And if we don't learn it, do you know what we do? We get stuck where we are and we guarantee ourselves that we're going to keep going through it until we learn it. And there are a whole bunch of people who are stuck right there. And I think that's the greatest impact that it has on the church. Number four is the impact on society. It is everywhere. There is almost no, and we're going to talk about this in more detail as time goes on, but there is almost no part of American society that is not impacted, and impacted substantially, from healthcare and healthcare costs, to mental health, to areas of personal responsibility, to issues of character. On and on they go of places in American society that have been impacted because of broken marriages and failed relationships. And then, of course, there's the impact on the institution of marriage. We're all concerned about the institution of marriage. And we have every reason to be, because all of the data suggests that it's not in very good condition. Do you know why this generation, we in my generation, it's real easy for us to sit back and say, well, these young kids, they have no respect for marriage. They don't. Do you know why? Let me tell you. It's because of the way we've lived it. Kids don't have respect for marriage because the marriage they were a part of in their family didn't work. And it didn't work because mom and dad didn't work it very well. And so they've been hurt and they've been damaged and they're angry. And they sit back and say, why in the world would I want to walk that path? I mean, if that's what it's like, and that's the statement right there, if that's what it's like, why would they? I want to be very careful what I say here. And I'm going to tell you up front, I have already prayed about this. And I have prayed that if you ever misquote me or take me out of context, I've asked God to strike you mute. So please, please, please hear me when I say this. I have some very strong feelings about gay marriage. And I understand that there are all kinds of cultural, institutional issues. I get that. But you know what blows my mind? It blows my mind that we spend millions of dollars, write and spread petition after petition, over what is ultimately going to be a tiny fraction of the marriages, when 40 to 50% of the marriages that meet our definition fail and no one seems to care. I don't get it. I do not get it. Christian people can stand up before God and these witnesses and vow and then go out and break the vow and no one ever says a word. It's as though we don't even care. I dare say that Christian people living marriage badly has as much or greater impact on the institution of marriage than gay marriage will ever have. And if you misquote me, I do. I pray you won't be able to speak a word the rest of your life. Now, and some of you are sitting back there saying, well, we have to stand for righteousness. Please, would you? Would you please stand for righteousness? Husband, go home and love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. If you do, she'll follow you anywhere. Wife, go home. Respect your husband. Stop making jokes about his fragile male ego and treat him like the leader that God designed him to be and you need him to be. And if you'll do that, he'll lay down in front of a train for you. Parents, go home. Love your kids. Love them more than money. Love them more than your lifestyle. Love them more than your job. Love them more than your career. Love them enough to teach them. Love them enough to discipline them consistently. Love them enough that when your child starts to wander, that you say to that child, listen, I love you too much to let you live this way, and then throw every roadblock you can find in front of them. And don't stop until they're back on track. Create an environment at home in which every person is respected and God is honored above everything else. You want to stand for righteousness, please? By all means, do it. You say, well, Don, you don't understand what I'm saying. We got to protect the institution. Can I tell you something? I don't care how much legislation you get passed. I don't care how much cultural pressure you bring to bear on the issue. You cannot protect the institution of marriage if yours is marginal or falling apart. You can't protect the institution. Do you know why this institution is being discarded? It has less to do about gay marriage than it does to do with how we live it. It isn't primarily the threat of gay marriage. And again, I have very strong feelings about that. It's being discarded because it didn't work. And it didn't work because we didn't work it. And we didn't live it the way God designed it. The best way to save the institution of marriage is to save your marriage. Is to say, I'm going to live my life so much like Jesus Christ that whatever it takes, whatever sacrifice I have to make, I am willing to do and will lead in doing it. So that ultimately my marriage can be saved and then maybe we can do something about the institution. No other solution is going to work. There isn't a single one that's going to work. No other solution is even worth discussing other than living like Jesus. In Matthew chapter 19, Jesus was asked the question. Group of Pharisees came to him. They were trying to trap him. They were doing it all the time. And they asked him, some Pharisees came and tried to trap him with this question. Should a man be allowed to divorce his wife for any reason? Now you need some background. There were two primary schools of thought among rabbinical schools. One, Rabbi Shammai and his followers taught that divorce was acceptable only in the case of sexual sin, adultery, sexual infidelity. Rabbi Hillel said divorce is possible for almost any reason whatsoever. In fact, if you read his writings, what he basically says is if she cooks a bad meal, you can throw her out if you want. Rabbi Akiba comes along a bit later and adds to it, if you find somebody better looking, he used the term fairer, then you have a right to divorce. And so you have this pull, and the Pharisees came to Jesus and they wanted to know what's the right answer, because they knew they were going to alienate him from somebody. And so Jesus gave them his answer. And he doesn't answer the way you think he would. He doesn't even refer to that, to the argument. He simply says, haven't you read the scriptures? I like that. Let's get back to the book. You know, haven't you read the scriptures? They record that from the beginning, God made them male and female. Now, why did he make them male and female? He said, this explains why a man leaves his father and his mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. He says, listen, God designed it this way. Don't you understand? Marriage is God's idea. It's not ours. This isn't basically a human institution. This is a divine institution. God created it, and God set the rules about how it's supposed to be lived. And listen to me carefully. The rules about how it's supposed to be lived when it's at its finest cannot be lived as anything other than a person who follows Jesus Christ with their heart, soul, and mind. Now, that's not to say you can't keep a marriage together, but listen, you're working on your own when you do it. If you want his help, you have to live it his way. He says, they're no longer two, but all of a sudden they're one. And then he comes through with this line, since they are no longer two, but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. No one. No one. You say, aren't there any circumstances? Yeah, there are. Can I tell you something, though? For Christian people, there should never be a situation in which divorce is necessary. Never. Let's be clear. The only reason for divorce between two Christian people is if one of them is living it so badly that they are living in hardened, unrepentant sexual adultery and will not quit. That's the only reason that there should ever be a divorce between two Christian people. Now, outside of that, there are some other circumstances. We can talk about that. But I'm talking to a room full of Christians this morning. And listen, we got to be honest with the passage here, and we got to tell the truth about what the Scripture says, because the truth will ultimately set you free. And there's no longer two but one, and God says, don't you dare split up what I've brought together. I think most people think marriage is really a two-way partnership. You know, I want you to imagine a husband and a wife. And there's two people, and they decide they're going to get married, and so they come together. That's our secular view of marriage, isn't it? You know, husband and wife, they come together, and the part that crosses, you know, they have their own individual lives, and they have their little part that kind of combines together. And in this image, this is not necessarily wrong, but what it suggests is this. The things that are going to keep them together, they have to come up with. They have to be the glue to their relationship. That is not a biblical view of marriage. The biblical view of marriage is that there is a three-way partnership, and that partnership is not just between you and your spouse, it is between you, your spouse, and God. And if he's in the mix, watch this, he glues you together, and not only does he glue you together, but he is the glue that keeps you together. So you want to improve your marriage? Let me tell you how to improve your marriage. Improve your spiritual life. Improve your spiritual life. Can you go back to that one more time? You see those arrows? You know, when husband, wife move toward God, do you know what you're doing? You're also moving toward each other. That's what happens when God glues you together. And when you move apart from God, can I tell you something? You're moving apart from your spouse. Because there is such a unity that God creates. Folks, I'm just telling you, in this image, there is so much rich theology that it would keep you working for weeks. I mean, it is spectacular how God brings all this together. But the simple message for us is this. If you want to improve your marriage, you got to move toward God, because when you move toward God, you move toward each other. And when you pull away from God, you pull apart from each other, and you're dooming your relationship. You say, well, Don, how do I grow spiritually? All right, let me give you four things, and then I got to quit. Number one, read the Bible for application. Read the Bible for application. You know how most people read the Bible? They read the Bible to say they've read it today. Or they read the Bible for knowledge. And there's nothing wrong with reading the Bible to get knowledge. But read the Bible for application. That means ask God before you start, what do you want me to learn today? Teach me what I need to know. Help me see things that are going to make my life with you and ultimately my relationships better as a result of it. Read the Bible for application. Number two, pray for your spouse and your kids every day. I've asked this. Marriages that fall apart, Christian people, I ask them, how much did you pray for your spouse? And I never quite get an answer, because there isn't one. Every time I do marriage counseling, I look at husband and wife, and I say, listen, you got to promise me something. You are going to pray for your spouse every day. Do you know why that's important? Because you can't stay mad at somebody you're praying for. You can't do it. God will do something inside of you that will begin to change you. And see, do you understand this? Fixing your marriage has absolutely nothing to do about the other person. It has everything to do with you. I don't care who caused the problem. Fixing it is your problem. Both of you. I mean, you're in this mess together, right? Number three, ask God to show you what's broken. I need to warn you. This is a prayer He will answer. He will begin to show you what's broken. He'll begin to put His finger on some very particular places. You'll see things that you didn't see before, and you won't necessarily like what you see. But it lets you do number four, and that is ask for forgiveness and fix it with His help. You say, is this a one-time thing? No, this is an everyday event. All four of these are everyday events. But if you'll begin to do it, you know what's going to happen? He's not going to conform your behavior. He's going to transform it from the inside out. He's going to change the inside of you to the degree that your behavior will naturally change, or at least He will give you the power to exercise the steps that need to be taken so that you can begin to fix the relationship. Now, I have an assignment for you this week. My assignment is this. Begin doing these four things. Begin doing them. Read the scriptures for application. Pray for your spouse and your kids every day. Every day, ask God, show you. Where am I broken today? What needs fixed? And then if you need to, go to whomever, your spouse, your kids, whomever it is, go to them and ask for forgiveness. You say, well, that's hard. Of course it is. You got to be humble to do that. Proud people never go and say, I'm sorry, would you please help me? They never do. But we also have to understand something else. God resists the proud, and He gives grace to the humble. And so begin doing these four things and do them every day without exception. Okay? Come back, same time next week.